Welcome to this exciting episode of Metaco Talks. And exciting because today we talk about digital asset ecosystems in Mauritius, South Africa, and Kenya. And I'm pleased to have two very distinguished experts in that field today with me, Angela Itzikowitz, as well as Ashwin Gupi. Thanks very much. Angela is an expert in banking and financial market regulation and reforms. You've been a distinguished academic as professor at Edward Nathan and an accomplished lawyer. You're part of several boards and regulatory committees, and I'm very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Ashwin, you've been very active as a voice in the virtual asset and fintech space, and you've also published on the topic in the Journal of International Banking Law and Regulation, for example. You're supporting various clients in the financial services industry, navigating the landscape in your role as partner at PwC at the moment. Many thanks for taking the time to discussing digital assets today with us, and also welcome.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's dive straight into it. Adoption of cryptocurrencies in emerging markets across Africa as well as Asia has largely been driven by rising inflation and depreciation of fiat currencies. However, the world of digital assets has so much more to do to it. And financial services companies around the world are bringing new products and services to market based on blockchain technology, while the regulatory landscape also across various jurisdictions is evolving and maturing. We will therefore focus our episode today on the much broader virtual and digital asset ecosystem beyond cryptocurrencies. And with that, as already mentioned, cryptocurrencies are just one side of the coin for applications of blockchain, even though they were the first ones, the first use case and applications on blockchain. But let me ask you, what are other assets which people should know about and will become much more important topics in the future also? And what do you probably also see specifically in South Africa and Mauritius?
Would you like me to go first?
Yes, please, Angela.
So I think you are quite right in alluding to the fact that there are certainly digital assets beyond crypto and that the terms are used interchangeably, but they actually aren't synonymous. And I always find the best way to draw a distinction between crypto assets and digital assets is to see digital assets as a set or a file of which crypto assets is a subset or a folder. But certainly the set digital assets encompasses a whole lot more. It, for example, encompasses non-fungible tokens, stable coins, CBDCs, I suppose, in a sense, although those are centrally issued, a myriad of different instruments beyond those simply of cryptos. So maybe just for the sake of the audience who isn't well-versed in the differences in terminology, maybe I can have a stab at a definition. It's not my definition, but really a conglomeration of definitions of the term. And really, a digital asset is nothing more than a non-tangible asset that is created, stored, traded, and transferred in a digital format. And if one accepts that definition, then in the context of blockchain, a digital asset could certainly include non-fungible tokens, other tokens, as well as crypto assets. I'll just stop there because I'm very conscious of not taking more than my share of time, but maybe I should say up front that notwithstanding the bigger ecosystem of digital assets as distinct from cryptocurrencies or crypto assets, both South Africa and Kenya, and I'll explain why later when we come to the regulation, have focused in their regulation on crypto assets rather than regulating the broader subset of digital assets. And I'll explain, as I say, moment why that is.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And Ashwin, maybe from your perspective, would you have any thoughts around which of those different assets beyond cryptocurrencies are important or what you're seeing in the market at the moment?
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you for this question. And I will certainly align myself with Angela here when she says that, you know, cryptocurrencies would probably be a subset of the general term, which is digital asset. Now, let me open a little bracket here and close it as soon as I possibly can. We do not necessarily have a global consensus on the legal taxonomy of all these tokens, okay? The term digital asset, to my memory, was first, or one of the organizations that first came up with the term digital asset would probably be the FATF, okay? In the 2013, 2014, 2016, something like that, where they came up with the first report, and where they define cryptocurrencies as a digital asset, okay, at that time. But they've moved on a little bit away from that. And in 2019, 2020, Mauritius adopted certain guide notes on digital asset, and they used that terminology to define a cryptocurrency. And however, now we have a comprehensive legal framework here in Mauritius, which is called the Virtual Asset Initial Token Offering Services Act, where cryptocurrencies is defined as a virtual asset. So again, we see that movement from one name to another, which can definitely throw a little bit of confusion. And a virtual asset, a cryptocurrencies, or virtual asset as it is legally called in Mauritius, is a centralized or decentralized it's a digital representation of a value that may be digitally created or transferred and may be used for payment or investment purposes. Now, this is the characteristics and the early definition of what a cryptocurrency was doing or what it was intended to be done by the inventor, Satoshi Nakamoto, of cryptocurrencies. So that has been captured by the definition by the FATF and also what we have on Mauritius. But then what follows is very important. It goes to say what it is not. It does not include fiat currencies, securities, and other financial assets that fall under the purview of the Securities Act. That, as far as the Mauritian definition is concerned. To close this bracket now, therefore, I agree with Angela. I think, you know, what we have to have is a global consensus where the term digital asset is the more generic term, which includes, in our case, virtual asset cryptocurrencies. And to answer your question now, blockchain is about the cryptocurrencies and application of blockchain, the blockchain technology. Okay, just to give you like some sort of a very non-conformal parallel, you've got a computer, and you know the Excel program is one application that you can put there. Word's another one. PDF is another one. So just like that, the technology, of course, is a very, very poor comparison. Don't run that up with me, but just to make a point here, we have other applications that can be made out of this technology, and we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg. The other one being that we have already seen is NFT, non-fungible tokens, that runs on different types of blockchains, for example, especially those that have smart contracts applications. You don't have NFTs on the Bitcoin blockchain, for example, but you can have it on the Ethereum blockchain. That Cardano blockchain as well provide this kind of this feature to create a kind of a token that is unique in itself. Now, the moment that you create a token that is unique, you can do, you know, as far as your creativity goes. And then you have other application of the token, of the digital, other types of digital asset, which you can link to another type of asset. The asset could be shares, for example. So if the underlying asset is a security, shares, debentures, and et cetera, you call that digital asset now a security token. So what we are seeing again, I'm aligning myself with Angela here, we call digital asset the big family, And under that, you have cryptocurrencies, which have the functionality that I've just defined as virtual asset inversions. You can have one which is an NFT. We can have one which has a real asset, a security, you call it a security token. You can have one which is linked to another asset, like a property, and et cetera, or a right to a property. So this is the concept of tokenization of assets. So and this goes on and on. You have stable coins, which are like a digital asset, but they've got like functionality to make them stable and not move up and down or volatile. And I mean, but the list goes on and on.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I certainly wouldn't want to confine myself to Excel on the computer. So I think we're also doing well in not restricting ourselves to only cryptocurrencies in the digital asset space. And Ashwin, you already alluded to the regulatory landscape in Mauritius being in flux. Could you help us understand a little bit the current regulatory and also the licensing environment governing digital asset markets in Mauritius, or then also in the wider area of South Africa?
Right. Okay. We enacted the Virtual Asset and Initial Token Offering Services Act last year. That came into force on the 7th of February, and I will call it VITOS to make things simpler. So the VITOS is in alignment with Recommendation 15 of the Financial Action Task Force. For those who do not know what the FATF is an organization that brings about like recommendations for the purpose of AML, CFT, money laundering, and combating or financing of terrorism. So they have like 40 recommendations, and one of the recommendations is Recommendation 15, which is about, you know, technologies and et cetera. So it provides that you have to have a regulatory framework or a fully entrenched legislative framework that's going to regulate the space. And one of those spaces that was and still is a potential influence for money laundering is, of course, blockchain technologies with these cryptocurrencies and et cetera. So in order to comply with Recommendation 15, we enacted the VITOS last year. Now, the VITOS provides licenses. It provides 5 licenses, and it regulates those activities. The licenses are, for example, stockbroking, having a marketplace, having a wallet, a custodian, and et cetera. So under the VITOS, we've got 5 regulated virtual asset service providers, VASP, as we call them, okay? Activities that are regulated. So if you come within those ambit and you're doing in business in or from Mauritius, you have to apply for a license with the Financial Services Commission, okay? Get license. But we didn't stop here. Now, this is a humongous space, as we would imagine. You know, we would gather right now, actually. The main legislation is that, but that is supplemented by a number of rules. For example, we got tribal rule is something which is extremely important when bearing in mind, you know, virtual assets is cross-border. So you have to have a rule that establishes how you become accounted for AML, CFT checks, and etc. So you got 8 rules that supplement the VITOS, which is client disclosure, custody of clients, publication of advertisements, risk management, statutory returns, as I say, travel rules, and other financial requirements. And beyond that, to finish off now, we also have guide notes. So the legal framework of Mauritius for virtual asset is comprised with VITOS, the legislation, rules that supplement that, and that those rules are keep changing and keep adding up to that. And then guide notes, which speaks of you know, stable coins. We have a guide note on stable coin. We've got because that space is so dynamic, this is why we have to go through supplementary a legislation that moves to adapt. We got a guide note on the NFTs. We got a guide note on DAO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization. I think it's still a draft guide note. That is another application of the blockchain, by the way. We've got guide notes on security tokens. And we got diagnosed on, I've said, stablecoins, NFTs, security tokens, and DAOs, yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. So it's different levels of guidance or regulation or licensing regimes, depending on, are you talking about certain assets versus are you talking about providing certain activities with those assets then?
Yes, and just very, very briefly to just bring off on that, and it aligns with your first question. What we have in Mauritius is that main act that governs the FOSS activities, which are service providers, but also we got guidance that's starting to recognizing things other than cryptocurrencies like stable coins, NFTs, DAO, security tokens, and etc.
Right. Angela, can I ask you how this aligns with what is happening in South Africa in the licensing and regulatory landscape?
Sure. If you don't mind, Katrine, can I abuse my position and just ask Ashwin one question? Ashwin, you speak about this all-encompassing statute and the activities that it covers. And you speak of guidance notes and policy papers, my word, not yours. Now, the perennial question for lawyers is whether these guidance notes are binding or non-binding. And if they are binding, they would assumingly take place in a subordinate regulation and would oblige issuers of stablecoin to meet the guidelines, even though they're not enshrined in principle legislation, or are they simply, as the name suggests, guidance notes?
Yeah, exactly, Angela, and thank you for this very interesting questions. No, they are not binding, but at the end of the day, if you don't follow the guidance note, you might yourself in trouble with the Financial Services Commission. Let me give you a very brief example to put things in perspective. We've got a guidance note on NFTs, for example. Okay, now NFTs under our guidance note has been categorized. They got three scenarios. Okay, one where the NFT is just like a virtual asset. Okay, the first scenario is where the NFT is the underlying asset is a digital picture, for example. Okay, now if this is it, then the FSC says we don't regulate that. The second scenario is where the NFT displays characteristics of securities. So, for example, it provides features of fragments ownership that you can sell to the public at large, okay? Because you've got certain rights and et cetera, or you're going to cash on profits because it's going to be invested and et cetera. So if that is the case, of course, it is a guidance note. But if it is the case, the FSC is going to use that guidance note to check your token. And if it's got security features and bang, and you've got license, you didn't follow the security rules, and this is where you run into trouble with them. And the other category is other NFTs, you know, the catch-all basket. And just probably it's worth, okay, we're all with Metaco here. We know the link between Metaco and Ripple, okay. And we all know what's happening with the SEC and Ripple, the big battle in the States. So what has happened in the States, again, here at least in Mauritius, we've got some guidance note where investors would know exactly, you know, okay, if I'm doing that, this would be securities, and then, you know, have to be careful. But what has happened what we've seen in the States is that, you know, the SEC lashed out using a very old principle, which is called the Howdy principle, not the Rowdy, could have called the Rowdy as well, but it's the Howdy principle coming from an old case in 1976, if I'm not mistaken, 1970s, where they apply certain basic like four pointers to determine whether something is a security or not. And they are now using that with the digital assets. And we are seeing the calamity that's happening in the States. And one of the cases that's being run right now at the moment is the XRP, which is the cryptocurrencies of Ripple. And the SEC is saying that XRP has characteristics of securities, and Ripple is saying, no. But nobody knows. And that's going to be a big litigation. But at least to sum up with regards to your question, we got those guidance notes. They are non-binding, but they give you a clear indication how the FSC, the regulatory body, is going to look at your token.
Thank you. See you.
And I think the positive outcome a few months ago was that the XRP token in and of itself is not a security, but there are certain outstanding questions still to be further discussed. But let me go back to the regulatory landscape also in South Africa. Angela, if I would hand over to you, if you could give us a bit of a picture of what's going on there.
Sure. By way of comparison, Katrina and Ashbin, I would say that the South African regulatory landscape is not nearly as advanced or as developed as the Mauritian regulatory landscape. Now, perhaps I can take a step back and explain to you why that is. And let me start off by saying, if you do any kind of search, you won't find a definition of a digital asset. And the reason for that is that in 2019, a workforce or a task force was constituted. It is known as the Intergovernmental FinTech Working Group, or its acronym is IFWG. Subsequent to that, a smaller group was established called the Crypto Assets Regulatory Working Group. So the intention and the focus of the IFWG, which was comprised of our conduct regulator, our prudential regulator, treasury, our revenue people, the intention was that they would start off by focusing on crypto assets specifically. And I was very fortunate, my law firm was very fortunate in that we were contracted to advise this IFWG on its policy considerations around crypto asset regulation and around the drafting of the crypto asset regulation. So, of course, the IFWG is cognizant of digital assets being a wider set, but decided to focus for now on crypto asset regulation as distinct from any other type of digital asset regulation. Having said that, and I'll speak to the regulatory framework in more detail in a minute, Katrina, I think probably the most important thing that I'm going to say today, and I don't know who the audience is, but it's this. Anyone wanting to launch any sort of digital asset, the first mistake anybody would make is to say, this isn't regulated. We know crypto assets are, we know about the IFWG, but there's no regulation for what we want to do. We want to issue an NFT, that's fine. We want to issue a token, a security token, or a utility token, it's fine. We don't have regulation dealing specifically with either of these tokens. Because South Africa, like the majority of other cases, a country regulation, it looks at the function of the instrument that you want to issue, and you have to test that instrument and the issue of that instrument against a whole body of law. Does it contravene the Banks Act? If you're going to lend a crypto asset, for example, would that be governed by the National Credit Act? And there that would involve a test as to whether lending speaks only of the loan of money rather than the loan of digital assets or crypto. You'd have to have regard to the National Payment System to define whether or not it is something that is regulated by the National Payment System. Or again, does the National Payment System speak only of money in the fiat sense of the word? So that, as I said, it's probably the best advice I can give today. I'll come back to your question in a minute, Katrine, but always test your offering, what it is you want to do in the South African market, against a raft of legislation. But going back to your question, South Africa, or the IFWG, decided that three initiatives would be embarked on. The first and the most pressing would be to include crypto assets again within the remit of the anti-money laundering legislation. And this has been done. Then it's an interesting definition because although it defines a crypto asset service provider, its reach probably covers more than simply crypto assets. Again, somebody wants to know whether the AML legislation applies to them. Can't just say, we know it applies to crypto assets. Owl isn't a crypto asset. You have to look very carefully at that definition. Now, I know we're going to speak about AML in a little more detail in a while, but that brings with it, once the instrument is classified as a crypto asset and is brought within the AML regime, it brings with that a host of very stringent compliance obligations. And again, my clients will say, I'm not worried about that because we do customer due diligence. We do record keeping. We do bring ourselves for credit purposes as a prudent organization within the realm of the anti-money laundering framework. Not so. The anti-money laundering framework sets out strict guidelines and stringent strictures that an entity regulated by it would have to comply. So that's the AML. Turning now to the second piece of regulation, as it were, was in October 2022. The Conduct Authority, the Financial Advisory Intermediary Services Act, issued a declaration saying that all, again, crypto assets would be financial products. They added to the list of existing financial products. However, you would only fall within the ambit of that statute if, in addition to there being a crypto asset, you were providing financial services in respect of it. Financial services are advice or intermediary services. So if you are rendering intermediary services or giving advice in respect of crypto, you would then have to register as a crypto asset service provider. At the same time as that declaration was issued, an exemption was passed, saying to the players already in the space, provided you meet certain requirements, you can carry on trading, but you only have until the end of November in which to register. And we see now clients scurrying to meet that registration requirement, because if they don't register as a crypto asset service provider by the end of November, then they will be trading in an unauthorized manner. They will be subject, it will be a criminal offense, subject to penalties and, of course, the penultimate criminal sanction. But importantly, the financial sector conduct, our market conduct regulator, will make public everybody not applied for a license. So this kind of that regulatory extension, which brings with it reputational risk. Quite interesting, and just to our original point and the thesis, or one of the theses, that digital assets and crypto assets are used interchangeably. So crypto assets are defined almost to the letter, has been as they are in the Mauritian legislation, mirrors the definition almost exactly. It then goes on to exclude NFTs, miners, and other entities. Now that again, to my mind, when I was looking at it in preparing for today, just shows that even the regulators themselves don't understand the distinction between crypto assets and digital assets, in as much as they thought to exclude what are not real assets. Sorry, just one point, if I may, Katrina, I'm very conscious.
Please, please. No, I think it's quite interesting what you're saying, that maybe the regulator doesn't understand fully everything what is going on in the digital asset world. And to your point earlier, companies which are working with digital assets in the financial services space probably don't know all the regulations which actually apply to them when they're working in the financial services space. So it's probably a steep learning curve on both sides. But please go on with your thoughts.
Thank you. Thanks, Katrine. So still staying with phase registration, where you have to register as a crypto asset service provider. As I say, end of November is the cutoff point. But the registration in and of itself has been a huge mission because of the novelty of adopting crypto assets as a bespoke financial product. And there's some crazy questions in that application. For example, please set out your experience in the crypto asset space. Please tell us what qualifications you have. Now, as I say, given the novelty of it as a distinct class, yes, there are courses now, but is that enough to say I've done a 6-week course at UCT with Angela or a year's at Harvard? Would that meet the experience requirement? And we've seen a lot of applications coming back to say, please elaborate on your experience requirements. So it's not plain sailing. But interesting, as long as you put in your application before the end of November, you can continue trading, even though you may not be registered before the cutoff date.
That would actually have been a question now from my side. When do we expect the licenses or the registrations to actually happen when you have applied and you know you have a deadline by November?
The short answer is, as long as you've submitted your application, it's as good as go. So you don't have to wait until you actually are registered. And our consumer protection and financial market regulation does not follow that pattern all the time. Sometimes only registration allows you to trade, where in others, simple submission allows you to carry on trading. The very last point I want to make, Katrin, if I may, on the regulatory framework. So one was AML, two was conduct standard financial services in respect of cryptos require a license, and the third is exchange control. And that for me has probably been the biggest source of frustration for my clients, not only in the crypto space, but also in the remittance space. And the reason for that, and I say this with respect, and for all I know, there may be people from the authority in the audience, but it really is time that the Prudential Authority, that the Financial Surveillance Department, that the Central Bank comes out and takes a stand as to whether crypto assets do or don't constitute capital for purposes of our exchange control. So just, Katrin, you may not be alive to these restrictions on the capital account coming from where you do, but pretty much you can't freely remit capital unless you have the proper permissions. So if those rules are going to apply to crypto, then the central bank has to start prevaricating. Either it does or it doesn't. Well, those are the three areas.
May I just follow the footsteps of Angela and ask her a question in return now?
Sure.
Before that, I'm thrilled that you put UCT and Harvard in the same phrase because I am also an alumni of UCT.
Wonderful. That was complete.
So it's true. You said something about, like, if you give advice with regards to cryptocurrency, you can potentially be considered as a crypto asset service provider. Now, is advice defined? Is it like financial advice, or what type of advice are we looking at here?
Yes, it's a very good question. Thank you for it, Ashwin. So there is a definition, and it's very, very broadly defined, and it's basically any advice in the form of recommendation or a judgment, not in respect of the service, but in respect of the financial product. It then does exclude things, though, such as factual information or information of an objective kind, which doesn't involve judgment of any kind. Quite interesting, Ashwin, just maybe as an add-on to your question. So it's both advice and intermediary services. Now, we've had a number of clients who curiously really want to register, not a number, but one or two, want to register as preferred service providers to give the market the comfort that they are regulated. But because they don't give advice and because they are not trading as intermediaries or offering an intermediary platform, but trading as principal or offering their services as principal, lending, for example, as principal, cannot register as a crypto asset service provider. More regulation will come, but this regulation doesn't cater for that category of activity.
We had a similar as I said initially, this is a huge space which is expanding constantly as we're speaking. We had somebody who was interested to see whether Mauritius has a regulatory framework with regards to collaterals of the trading and collaterals of virtual assets. But however, what's good about the Financial Services Commission is they are hyper dynamic. So within a week or two, they said they would be still considering as something that's doable, but it would be considered as a security in Mauritius.
But that's another marked difference. Like to put it on a block and say between your FSC and our Financial Sector Conduct Authority, they're very, very low.
We have been blessed to have officers at the Financial Services Commission, which are very, very proactive. I'll just give you a brief example. I had a client who wanted to have a DAO in Mauritius, a decentralized autonomous organization. And of course, we don't have a framework as yet. And at that time, we didn't even have the guidance note. And we were just, tossing ideas, and they were sitting on one side, we were sitting on the other side of the table. But you could see the synergy and the dynamism. And, at the end of the session, they just said, they just told me, why don't I give them a few ideas how we can amend this particular act? Or how about, we come up with a DAO Act? And a month later, we started hearing through the grapevine that, they are considering having a DAO Act to be implemented here in Mauritius. So yes, we have been blessed with this kind of, very forward-looking attitude so far, which we need if you want to make this market grow and keep in line with this evolution of the market. This is the kind of mindset you have from a regulatory perspective.
And I think it's great to see. Yes, please.
I'm so sorry. I feel like I'm usurping your position, Katrine, but it's
not at all.
Discussion and so dynamic in that the one is leading on to one thing leads on to another. So you'd be interested, Ashwin, and I'm glad to be able to say something of Kenya. We do have an office in Kenya, and I do a lot of work in Kenya, but I'm no expert on Kenya cryptos. But what you would find interesting is that the parliament, the Kenyan authority, as well as the Central Bank of Kenya, has now said to the Block, the Bitcoin Association of Kenya, you're full of criticisms. We try to impose a tax on crypto assets. Everything you do, you challenge. Here you go, Blockchain Association of Kenya. You help us draft the legislation. So Kenya is completely novel in that regard. And they've given a 2-month period in which to come up with the bill, driven primarily by competition that they are facing from other African jurisdictions. So I thought you'd, and the audience might be interested to hear, but thank you.
Right attitude. Yeah, thank you.
We actually have a question from the audience, and I will just pose it to you both. So just to confirm, the CASP licenses are relevant for operational and asset services and providers also. And the question is, like custodians, do they have to store and custodize the crypto keys, the private keys as well for digital assets?
Okay. If I may?
Please.
Right. Okay. We are talking about a custodian license, probably. I think this is what he has in mind. And the question is the role of the custodian to have access to a key? Well, the answer seems to be yes. We don't. It's not that elaborate in our law, but it you have to look at the report of the FATF, the initial report, and subsequent report as it was subsequently updated. It defines as when we have a private key, okay, which gives you control over the virtual asset. Now, the private key can be fragmented so that I have control, but my data is not sufficient to move the virtual asset within the blockchain. I need somebody else to put his or her private key together. So this is how custodian works in the majority of cases. There would be certain custodians that will have full control over the asset because you need them to trade very, very rapidly. But otherwise, if you're doing safekeeping, this is usually how it would work. So to come back to the question, the moment what the FATF provides, the moment that anybody has control, even if it is not full control, even if you require the participation of someone else, that would make you a custodian. So I've answered the question in reverse. So therefore, yes, the custodian usually is somebody who has control over the asset, yeah. The virtual asset. There's another license in Russia which is called the wallet service providers. Now, the distinction between the custodian license and the wallet service provider seems to be that the word wallet service provider does not have control. It's just providing that service. And the full control rests with the owner of the virtual asset. I hope I've answered the question.
Very interesting distinguishment. Thanks very much for that. And we've talked a lot about kind of how the regulator sees it or how the regulation is evolving. What is your view on what's the market's perception on that in the different areas? Or also, how are they actually tackling to think about, okay, we need to apply for a license. Like, what are kind of the steps they need to think about?
Would you like to go first?
Yes, me, Katrin. Maybe not that seriously, but the market has received the regulation very well and very broadly. So when the amendment was made to what we'll call it the market conduct regulation phase, we actually gave an opinion saying that the regulators couldn't simply add another financial product to an existing list of financial products. We gave an opinion that that was ultra vires their powers and we would have to go through a much more lengthy legislative process, and they couldn't just wake up one morning and add it to the list. And that came out in the comments because the people were given an opportunity to comment on the proposed registration as crypto asset service providers. But nobody was prepared to challenge the regulator on their view. And within a very short time, the players accepted this and were very welcoming of it. So much so, as I said earlier, Katrin, we have clients who really want to register but can't yet because they don't render intermediary services or provide advice. But certainly a willingness. Happy to be regulated. Initially, there was a lot of talk around self-regulatory organizations and self-regulatory body. But I think that's gone. And people really do want to bring themselves within the ambit of the law.
If I may, this is what we've seen as well. You know, if we look at the evolution of the space, okay, we started being in a far west which was not regulated. And now it is a very lucrative business, very highly, highly lucrative business, okay? But there are roads and there are like serious, you've got serious players, serious business people. And these people, they want to be regulated because if they are regulated, it's like a seal of our quality of acknowledgement, etc. It makes them it gives them a better way to market themselves, to tell because it's about, you know, providing trust and trust to their clients. So a client would rather go to an exchange, for example, which is regulated, as opposed to an exchange which is not regulated. So we have seen that. You know, I had a case, a guy who insisted that we find a license, that he comes with one of those five licenses, and we look at his business model and said, no, I don't think you do. And said, no, we find one. You know, we need to be regulated. We need to come under one of those five categories. So this is what we're seeing, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Let me jump ahead a little bit. And Angela, you already mentioned it. AML is quite an important topic. Could I ask, what are your thoughts on the AML regulation, what we are seeing being implemented, and also what the effect is on the industry or on different players in the industry in your respective markets?
Two strands to this, Katrine. So I do think that in compliance with the FATF standards, given that exchanges and the cryptos can be used for money laundering purposes, I think it's correct and in keeping with what most other jurisdictions are doing to bring crypto assets within the anti-money laundering regime. But as I alluded to earlier on, this imposes significant compliance obligations on an entity. I understand that a lot of the exchanges don't deal with companies, and there isn't an issue of an ultimate beneficial owner, but that ultimate beneficial owner is causing huge headaches, having to screen against sanctions less to the extent that we are obliged to screen, ascertaining who politically exposed persons are, all of which have a good cause and are salutary in their heart, but it's just making it very, very difficult to comply with the anti-money laundering legislation to the letter. In addition, everyone who plays in that space has to have a compliance regulatory, what's it called, CRMP, compliance regulatory monetary policy. I probably twisted the acronym around a bit, but that's a very detailed document, enormously detailed, stating out what your obligations are, or rather how you will comply with them. And the regulators, in imposing penalties, looks as much at compliance with the regulation as it does with the compliance risk management program. The second strand is that reform, and this is a very worrying trend, is that banks, for a while, completely closed the bank accounts of persons who were playing in the crypto space. They didn't want those who had bank accounts, or that the bank terminated them. I mean, that's a very interesting body of law, whether you can simply terminate somebody's account, what kind of notification you have to give them, as it's a subject of much litigation in South Africa, and will be stringently regulated when our Conduct of Financial Institutions Act is amended. But leaving aside any RD principle, leaving aside any legislation, the banks were simply saying, we don't want you. The risk is too much. We don't want to, we just can't run the risk. It could be assets or proceeds of money laundering. We don't know what the genesis of this money is. We know it's borderless. We know it's anonymous to a certain extent, and we don't want to deal with it. So much so that our former, the deputy governor of our central bank came out and said to the banks, you must stop this. You must bank and continue to clients who have play in the crypto asset space. But I'm trying to register a client of mine now who's applied for a crypto asset services provider license. But because it's onshore and offshore, very difficult to get a bank, to find a bank who will happily bank that client. Mm-hmm. So those are the two strengths I wanted to touch on.
this is a global phenomenon, seven except with a very few countries like Switzerland and etc. Now, you also write, Angela, you know, debanking. I think in November last year, the South Africa Reserve Bank issued a communique warning banks about debanking. But this is the very right way. Debanking is the right and perfect way to make money laundering proliferate. And I tell you why. You know, today we are having regulations and a regulatory framework regulating exchanges where these exchanges will have certain responsibilities with regards to AML CFDs, for example. Now, if you don't need these exchanges, they are fully licensed with the, like, Financial Services Commission here in Mauritius, but they need a bank account to operate. So if you cut access to the other bit of the vitality to make the whole business function, what you're doing, you're pushing them away. You're killing them, you're pushing them away. But when you do that, instead of having a regulated space where people can come and trade, and these VAS, the virtual asset service providers, they've got the obligation to comply with the AML CFD frameworks, you're pushing them away to push people to go into a peer-to-peer. Now, this is where it happens. Money laundering is not happening that much on exchanges, or I'm not saying that's not happening, but yeah, there's regulated, you know, like I'm not going to name exchanges, but I know some of the exchanges. If they do, like, they have a wallet, you want to trade with them, you set a wallet with them, you put in cryptocurrencies. Well, strictly speaking, the cryptocurrencies don't stay in the wallet, but for the purpose of simplicity, so you put in cryptocurrencies in the wallet. And the moment that they find out that those cryptocurrencies have been into the darknet, for example, they cancel, they have a contractual relationship with you where you agree that they're just going to shut down access to the whole wallet, because bear in mind, they are custodian and they have part of the control access to the virtual asset. Now, these are the kind of things that we should see. Now, if you don't have, you're debanking, you have a debanking policy, you will push people to carry on trading because people will do it. And we have a tendency of thinking that, you know, money laundering became into existence after 2009. But money laundering has always been around. I would ask you a simple question. That dollar that you have in your pocket, can you guarantee me that it has not been rolled and sniffed cocaine with? Guarantee me that. You can't. But still, we're accustomed, we're used to it. We are formatted now to accept, you know, fiat currency as they are. But we're not ready to do that. And yet, you know, cryptocurrencies, the virtual asset, offer better tests with the new tools that we have now to determine where they've been. But it's a change of the mindset. To finish off on that point, and this is one thing that I'm advocating, you know, you can train a tech person to understand a finance world, but it's very hard to train a graduate into the finance world to make him understand the tech nitty-gritties. So what banks and financial institutions should start thinking now in terms of their recruitment, to start taking people with tech backgrounds more and more and more. You can train them to understand a finance product. So it's a change of culture.
But you know, sorry, Katrina, I know it's almost time, but if I can just respond or add to that point. I fully understand the reluctance and the resistance of the banks historically to take on crypto exchanges where there's a suspicion, rightly or wrong, the subject of suspicion, that the monies may be proceeds of unlawful activities. But surely now, on a positive side, the fact that the crypto asset exchanges or the players in the crypto asset space themselves have to do stringent anti-money laundering compliance. They have to meet the same requirements as a bank does because of the functional approach to regulation. So what the crypto asset service provider must in implementing its anti-money laundering policy, do just what the banks have to do. Of course, I understand the risk-based and the risk weights must be very different. But should be the banks some comfort. And there are also mechanisms in our anti-money laundering legislation, which might allow the banks to not quite piggyback, but to draw some of the anti-money laundering or the customer due diligence screening tests that the crypto service provider itself has done. So hopefully that will give them the comfort. Otherwise, as you say, those are the consequences or the results to which one will be driven. Peer-to-peer lending and effectively a kind of a Hawana banking system.
But hopefully we see the regulation as well as then the market respectively going in a different directions, that we actually have well-governed markets in the future. As we are, you already mentioned it, as we are approaching the top of the hour, Angela, Ashwin, thank you both very much for being at Metaco Talks today. It's been a huge pleasure, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, but it was an extremely interesting episode. To get your insights today has been very interesting. And I'm sure our guests enjoyed it as well. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll announce you when the recording of the conversation will be available on metaco.com. And stay tuned for the next episodes towards end of November. And in the meantime, please follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter, and feel free to let us know your feedback.
Well, thank you very much for having us, Catherine, and the Metaco team, of course.
Yes, many thanks, Catherine, Bradley, Metaco. It was so interesting. We could have carried on speaking for hours and hours.
We can.
But and really appreciate
it. You're moderating our insight as well, Angela. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you. And indeed, the audience.